In response to the judiciary branch's recent approach to the foreclosure process in New York, state lawmakers approved a measure this spring to ensure mortgage lenders and loan servicers are following the spirit of existing laws designed to protect homeowners. With the bill awaiting the governor's signature, we wanted to examine what's at stake with this admittedly wonky issue. And to do that, we're joined by Jacob Inwald, Director of Foreclosure Prevention for Legal Services NYC. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Thank you.
So let's turn to the issue at hand. And from my reading of the legislative memorandum that accompanies the bill we're going to talk about, Democratic lawmakers are unhappy with the judicial foreclosure process, arguing that there are basically abuses in the current system as the result of a ruling from the State Court of Appeals, as well as a mid-level appeals court. What seems to be the problem?
Well, first of all, it's not just Democratic lawmakers. This bill had the support of 10 Republican lawmakers as well. But what this bill addresses is an admittedly very arcane issue affecting statute of limitations in foreclosure cases. For the benefit of your audience, statutes of limitations are integral to our judicial system going back really for centuries. The notion is that claims become stale after a certain period of time if you don't pursue them and have them adjudicated within a certain period of time. So what's going on in this particular area is that in the years following the Great Recession, where there were astounding numbers of foreclosure cases brought, the mortgage servicers resorted to using law firms that have volume practices that prosecuted thousands and thousands of cases because, for the most part, they were able to rely on the fact that distressed homeowners did not have access to lawyers who could actually challenge them. So they basically filed mass-produced complaints that were based on what was referred to as robo-signed affidavits, where people who actually had no personal knowledge of what they were doing or testifying to signed off on hundreds of thousands of pleadings and affidavits submitted to the courts in support of foreclosure cases. When that came to light, the courts started issuing certain rules that required that lawyers filing these papers signify that they had done some basic due diligence and satisfied themselves that, in fact, there was a legitimate basis and there was evidence to support the claims that they were pursuing in court, the way any lawyer pursuing a claim in court is obligated to do, but which required a special rule to govern foreclosure plaintiffs' law firms. That threw a monkey wrench into the process, and thousands of cases across the state ground to a halt because the lawyers were not willing to sign off on what they were required to sign off on. It came to be known as the shadow docket, and it put borrowers in a state of limbo because they had been sued in foreclosure. And once you're sued in foreclosure, the lender has accelerated your debt. That means it will accept nothing from you except the full amount of the debt that's due. It won't accept monthly payments, and it will typically reject monthly payments. They also can't talk to their lender because cases were filed in court, which means that the lender was represented by an attorney, and we have something, you know, that's known as the no-contact rule. If a party is represented by an attorney, you can't just go and contact them directly. They called their mortgage servicers to try to work, you know, discuss with them some kind of workout or loan modification. They would say, we can't talk to you. The case is in litigation, even though the case was in this sort of suspended animation of what came to be known as the shadow docket. So it took the courts a long time to plow through those cases. Many of those cases got dismissed. Many other foreclosure cases got dismissed for other reasons, because the plaintiffs didn't comply with various aspects of law governing foreclosure cases, and they realized the cases were fatally defective, and therefore they voluntarily discontinued those cases, often after the statute of limitations had already run. There's a six-year statute of limitations in these cases, and once they started that case, their first case, that statute of limitations began to run. If they then discontinued that case that they brought and then tried to bring a new one, those cases were barred by the statute of limitations. This is not anything new or novel. This has been the law for a long, long time. And it was the recent, relatively recent decision by the Court of Appeals in the case known as Engle that upended that state of affairs and basically said a lender who has voluntarily discontinued that prior case, they get to magically reset their statute of limitations. No other type of litigant gets that kind of second bite at the apple. You know, the statute of limitations either runs or it doesn't, and the courts really have no flexibility to extend them at all. But here they've given the banking industry and the mortgage servicers essentially the ability to reset and manipulate the statute of limitations at their convenience.
I'm curious whether you think that ruling in Engle has the potential to be a precedent in other areas. Do you think other litigants are going to look at this ruling in the future and be like, boy, I'd like to have that superpower when it comes to statute of limitations moving forward? Or is the ruling written in a way that it's specifically tailored to the players involved in this case?
Well, it's not specifically tailored to the players involved in the case. It affects a large number of cases in New York State. But I think it does reflect what was going on in this particular industry. The statute of limitations operates differently in other contexts. Mm-hmm. It's strange, but a lender, unlike almost any other litigant, gets to choose when its statute of limitations starts to run, because they can't foreclose on a loan if you just miss one payment, right? You miss one monthly payment, and the statute of limitations is only running on that one monthly payment. To be able to actually exercise their right to foreclose, because the borrower is not making payments, they have to what's called accelerate the loan. That means they have to call the entire amount due. And they get to choose when they do that. So these are parties who they had the option, unlike any other litigant, to decide when they should or when they would accelerate the loan, call the amount due, and when the statute of limitations starts to run. There isn't really, you know, another context where thing other than lending, you know, with monthly installment payments, I don't see this translating to other areas of commerce necessarily. It's primarily affecting foreclosure actions on real property.
So then turning to the legislative response to this ruling, what would the bill that made its way through the Capitol do? Would it simply say that the ruling from the Court of Appeals is no good, essentially enshrine that language into law?
The primary thing that this bill is doing is restoring the law to where it was before the Court of Appeals got involved. And perhaps I should have said, the intermediate appellate courts that had considered the issue all came down the same way. They all held that, you know, just because a lender voluntarily discontinues a prior foreclosure action, that doesn't mean that they, quote, revoked the acceleration of the loan, which is what the argument that they sort of came up with after the fact when they realized they had these statute of limitations problems. So that's the main thing that it does. And the reason the ruling in the Engle case from the Court of Appeals made no sense is because in the real world, what was going on in these cases, when those lenders voluntarily discontinued those cases that were plagued with fatal defects, they were doing that because they were going to lose those cases. And they did it so they could start a new case and they could get their paperwork right and be able to prevail. They weren't doing it because they had settled the case, even though the Court of Appeals was sort of acting in this parallel universe where, in fact, that's they posited that that's what was going on. But in fact, none of these cases would have even been litigated had that been the case, because if it had been settled, there would have been no issue around the statute of limitations. It also addresses other practices around the statute of limitations that the courts have been sometimes fairly indulgent of fairly abusive behavior. So it addresses this notion that plaintiffs tried to reset the statute of limitations by just unilaterally saying or sending a letter saying we revoke acceleration, when again, they're doing that because they recognize they have a statute of limitations problem and they want to start a new case and not be bound by the statute of limitations. This law would make clear, consistent with existing law, that if, you know, the parties are free to agree among themselves to suspend or toll the statute of limitations, but you can't just as a lender have this unilateral right you know, to do these stealth accelerations where the borrower has no idea that that's what's happening. And then another issue that the legislation addresses, and I apologize, this is very, very much in the weeds on lawyerly issues.
No need to apologize. We appreciate the pro bono advice.
But there was a an intermediate court ruling from the appellate division for the Third Department, which addressed another effort that lenders made to bypass the statute of limitations in a situation where court had ruled that a foreclosure action was barred by the statute of limitations. The lender then went and said, okay, well, I'm not going to do a foreclosure action. I'm going to start what's called an action on the note. And a lender who has a mortgage on a property who has extended a loan has two remedies, and it has to pick one of them. It either, you know, it can bring an action to foreclose the property, or it could bring an action for a money judgment on the note. You owe me this on the promissory note that you signed, and I want to collect on it. Typically, they do it in the context of seeking to foreclose on the real property, because that's the easiest way for them to, you know, to recoup the loan that they extended. But so in this particular case, and no other court has really accepted this, they had been already ruled to have been barred by the statute of limitations on their foreclosure case, so they then went and just started a new case to collect on the note. And the appellate division for the Third Department said, oh, yeah, that's fine. You can just go ahead and do that. And that was never what was intended under the statutes that govern these cases. And so this legislation clarifies that as well. And then it makes a few other technical clarifications and fixes about certain grace periods that litigants get if their case is dismissed and when they can bring a new case and still have it deemed timely, even if a new case would otherwise have been barred by the statute of limitations.
And does the bill take effect retroactively, or does this only impact future cases?
The rhetoric about retroactivity has been a little overheated. It's, you know, because this is a remedial bill that is trying to correct something that the Court of Appeals has done and which has caused so many cases around the state to be exhumed from the dead, you know, from their graves. Cases that were ruled to be barred by the statute of limitations because of the Engel decision, the courts are now having to hear motions where the plaintiffs, where the banks, are trying to get those cases revived because of the changed ruling in Engel. To address that, the bill says that it will take effect and affect cases that are currently pending in which a judgment of foreclosure hasn't already been enforced. So if a case is already done, it's done.
I think you used the term so many cases to describe the quantity. What does that mean, though, in reality? Are we talking about hundreds of cases around the state, thousands of cases? What does it look like?
So the courts operate slowly. Unquestionably, there are hundreds. I monitor the decisions that come out from the appellate courts every week, and almost every week there are one or two or three decisions basically changing the result of a case because of the Engel decision. I could envision it's actually, you know, more than hundreds, but I don't have the ability to give you, you know, a quantity of cases. But I do know that what I see anecdotally is this is happening in lots of cases. And we certainly, you know, I oversee a practice covering New York City where all of our advocates are dealing with these issues and seeing efforts by the plaintiffs to bring what should be dead cases back to life.
Opponents of this measure argue that it will have the net effect of making mortgage credit a riskier proposition, which could then make it harder for some New Yorkers to obtain a mortgage in the future. Is that a realistic outcome if this bill becomes law?
Yeah, you have to forgive me for rolling my eyes when I hear that. I know we're on the radio, so you can't actually see my eyes, but that's what they're doing. So we have heard this refrain with virtually every single enactment, you know, over the last 15 years that New York has done that touches on the foreclosure and lending processes. And they say those words, but what are the reasons why it will make credit more expensive? What is it that about complying with the statute of limitations that every type of litigant has to comply with is going to make it more expensive to lend in New York? All they have to do is commence their case within 6 years. You don't have to finish your case in 6 years. You just have to start the case within the 6 year statute of limitations. You know, so they say that, and they say it's going to disincentivize them from working with homeowners, you know, to resolve cases, to do what we call loss mitigation.
That was going to be my next question.
So, like, why is that the case? Like, what? First of all, there is a legal obligation under New York law if you want to pursue a foreclosure, you have a statutory obligation to negotiate in good faith to do loss mitigation. So what is it about this legislation that is going to motivate the lenders to violate that law? If anything, the fact that they can't just stop and start the statute of limitations at their whim is an incentive to resolve cases and to work with homeowners and to not let them drag on forever and ever and risk losing the case based on the statute of limitations. The rhetoric is out there, but it's not substantiated by anything that the bill actually does.
And finally, this legislation is being pushed because of a ruling from the state's top court, as well as a ruling from a mid-level appeals court. So I'm curious whether you think the state judiciary and the state's Court of Appeals in particular is consumer-friendly, generally speaking, when it comes to these homeowner issues.
That's a difficult question for me to answer. The judiciary is not a unitary entity. There's a lot of different judges deciding cases, and the Intermediate Court of Appeals that has considered the issues that Engel addressed came down uniformly a different way than the Court of Appeals did. So they more or less understood the statute of limitations. And by the way, those courts, especially the Second Department, which covers most of New York City and downstate and Long Island, except for the Bronx and Manhattan, they have an incredible volume of foreclosure cases before that court. And they've developed a fair amount of expertise. They handle, I can't even, countless numbers of these cases. If you, you know, they issue their published decisions every Wednesday. And if you look, every week there are at least 10 to 20 just foreclosure case decisions. So they have a familiarity with what's going on, and they understood what was going on in terms of gaming the system with the lenders trying to manipulate the statute of limitations, which I think is why they were actually less indulgent of the bank's arguments that their having voluntarily discontinued a case, you know, meant that it reset the statute of limitations. The Court of Appeals really doesn't see these cases very often, so they don't have the same level of expertise. Individual judges have different predilections, but I will say that, you know, consumer advocates were kind of shocked how the Court of Appeals came down in the Engel case, because it seemed like a tremendous long shot for the banks to try to get, you know, what were unanimous rulings from the three appellate divisions that had considered the issue. It was fairly shocking that the Court of Appeals came down with this bright line rule that reflected very little familiarity with what goes on the ground. And it was also surprising. Usually the Court of Appeals wouldn't be expected to even take up an appeal if all the intermediate appellate courts that have considered the issue have come down the same way.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Jacob Inwald. He's the Director of Foreclosure Prevention for Legal Services NYC. Jacob, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to do it.
Support for the Capital Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.